This is the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and I believe we are joined now by Frederick Ziemana. I'm sorry. Are you there,
yes,
sir?
Yes, Ziemana, yes.
Yep. I pride myself on my ability to pronounce his name, and then when I get you on the air, I botch it. So my apologies. Mr. Ziemana, you are a coordinator or one of the coordinators of survivors and victims of the 1972 genocide in Burundi. And, of course, you are a Burundian and your family was from there. Let's just cover that to begin with. What happened in 1972? And is it true that you lost members of your family in that situation?
Yes. Okay. As you said, my name is Frederick, and yes, I'm principal coordinator of the Collective of Survivors and Victims of the 1972 Hutu Genocide. Mm-hmm. I've got a master's degree of R in anthropology with a thesis on ethnicity in Burundi.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad and my spouse's dad were both killed in the 1972 genocide against the Hutu by the Michel Michombero Tutsi dominated the regime.
Mm-hmm. What occasion it? How? When did this? Did you have by definition a government based on ethnicity, or was it explicit? Can you tell what were they doing, and what led up to this?
In the spring and summer of 1972, the government arrested and executed more than 300,000 men, women, and children whose only crime was being of the Hutu ethnic group, and no one of the perpetrators was ever brought to justice until today, 43 years later. How do we know? Evidence that it was a genocide against the Hutu, because there are three criteria for a genocide.
Mm-hmm.
One is the planification, and 1972 there was a list of names of people to be killed. The second criteria is how you target who you're going to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1972, only members of the Hutu ethnic group were targeted and killed. And the third criteria is when you use the government the institutional army and police and whatever to kill the people. And
mm-hmm.
that's what happened in 1972. The army, the police, the supervisors, the public service, the party, anything in the government was used to make sure that no one of those who were on the list could escape.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened in 1972 was, yes, a genocide against the Hutu led by the Tutsi-dominated regime.
Uh-huh. By the way, I believe that, of course, it's some years ago, although not that many years ago, that this happened. But and there is a consensus, is there not, about that it did occur and on the magnitude that you speak of. It's just simply that nothing was done about it.
Yeah, nothing has been done against that. And that's why what we've been reading, what is happening right now in Burundi, is going to be in the mirror of what happened in 1972, because we members, it's how we watch what is happening in Burundi, because there is always something that tells us, we keep asking ourselves, and if it was the same coming back. And when you observe and watch what is happening in Burundi, there is science and the clue of what happened in 1972 and after.
Yeah. Again, we're speaking to Fred Ziemana, and he is the coordinator of survivors and victims of the 1972 genocide in Burundi. Of course, there's always an echo in this matter, political one, that you, Burundi is a close neighbor of Rwanda and has basically the same demographic components, does it not? It's the Hutu and Tutsi populations, but also the former colonial power. You have also almost all the same. You're kind of like twins, political twins.
Yes. Both countries, Rwanda and Burundi, they do have the same. As anthropologists, I can tell you that they do have the same group. There are Hutu and there are Tutsis and there are Twa, three groups. Mm-hmm. And the percentage of these ethnic groups are exactly the same. Hutu are the majority in both countries, in Rwanda and in Burundi. They are about 85% of the population, while the Tutsi group is composed of about 14%, a bit less in Rwanda, and close to 15% in Burundi.
Mm-hmm.
The language is quite the same. Burundian can understand easily Rwandese, and Rwandese can understand easily Burundian, which tells us that traditionally this country may be, maybe it was the same population. And yes, as you said, they have both been colonized by the same country, which is Belgium. Mm-hmm. And at the independence, the heritage of the independence was this kind of ethnic problems in both countries. Belgium, as anthropologists, I can tell you that, especially for, I can speak for Burundi because I did some researches on this when I was doing my master's degree at Montreal University.
Mm-hmm.
And what the, if you want to understand exactly why this ethnic political crisis in Burundi, you need to read the change that the Belgium administration did in Burundi in 1925,
mm-hmm.
where what they tried to do, there was one group, the one who was leading the politics, the monarchy. Belgium want to really to squish people who were in power at the time with the Tutsi.
Mm-hmm.
He want to take the monarch had in territories Hutu chiefs, and Belgium want to squish these Hutu chiefs with a candidate from the Tutsi Hima group. Because Belgium thought that the Tutsi Hima were from a group who was on power in that Burundi, but it was a different group. It was the Ganwa.
I see.
Yeah. But what happened, they took any chief who was from 1925 and was exchanged with Tutsi Hima candidates. And the point is that this group, especially this ethnic group of Tutsi Hima, were not associated in any way with who were on power or with the other group of Tutsi or the other group of Hutu. And what happened is that since this time, these Tutsi Hima were not associated with power, took the advantage to kill those who were on power and to kill at the same time the Hutu, so that they can remain on power, and they did, and they succeeded, because since the independence, this is the group that has been leading Burundi for the last 40 years, with no change at all.
Yeah. Well, now, I wanted to thank you for that background, the colonial setup, which the people inherited. Now, you went through, just starting with, for example, the massacres and genocide of 72. Since then, you've had so much political struggle and violent struggle. There's been heavy fighting. And then eventually, there was an agreement to have elections. I guess you've gone through a number of these. Some have failed, right? You did. If I remember rightly, did you not elect the first time, for the first time, a Hutu to be president in 1993? Is that right? And somehow there was, I guess, an internationally observed election, and for the very first time in the history of Burundi, the majority elected someone who was from the majority. And what happened?
Yes, in 1993, and that's the time that I came here in Canada, there was an election, the first democratic one, because it was democratic, the majority elected a first Hutu president, Melchior Ndadaye.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we were very hopeful that the country was coming over the old ethnic group, but it didn't last more than only 3 months. So he was elected in June, and by October 21st, this president was assassinated by exactly the same army group that was there before,
mm-hmm.
with probably the initiative of the one who was the president, Pierre Buyoya.
Mm-hmm.
And from that time, after the assassination, of course, people from Burundi could understand that it was always the same pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how there was a kind of civil war in 1993, people trying to recover democracy. And this created a rubber group, the
mm-hmm.
CNDD-FDD, which is kind of a party to fight for the return to democracy. And this is the party that is actually ruling Burundi right now.
Yeah. And one other detail, just to clarify. So your first elected president, democratically elected president, Mr. Ndadaye, was killed in November of 1993. Is that right?
Yes.
And then
October 21st, 1993.
October. Thank you.
Yeah.
And then some months later, the Hutu president who succeeded him was murdered in the plane along with President Habyarimana in Rwanda in April of 1994. Is that right?
That's true.
That's a double blow. You lost two Hutu presidents in less than a year.
Yes, in less than a year, we lost two Hutu presidents.
Mm-hmm.
In less than a year, and yes, both in the first murder and the second, Rwanda was involved because President Kagame was in Burundi and visited the army of Burundi before the first president was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And second, the second one is going to be assassinated, the plane is going to be shot with President Habyarimana again in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes two cases. And I can tell you enough cases where Rwanda was involved was in 1995 at the university campus of Bujumbura.
Mm-hmm.
Over 100 of Hutu students were killed, massacred by the counterparty Tutsi students, and with again the invitation of President the invitation of Paul Kagame. He was not president yet at that time. He was vice president.
That very special position.
Mm-hmm. And he invited me to see students to kill the Hutu students, saying, do it the way we did it at the National University in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, again, we're speaking to Fred Ezeyamana. He is the coordinator of the survivors and victims of 1972, and we, of course, want to understand what's going on in Burundi today. And with that background, you, as you pointed out, there has been a long struggle, most of it an armed struggle, frankly, that resulted in a political agreement to organize elections. And the elections were won by the present leader of Burundi, is that right? Gerera? I'm sorry.
Yes, after the third president was killed in a plane in Rwanda, there was a third Hutu president who replaced him. And this one would run, I think, about a year and a half, and then a coup d'etat would occur from the same group who were ruling the country before.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that time, the United Nations and especially the environment of Nelson Mandela, they managed they invited both parties to an agreement, and this would become the Arusha agreement, which would provide a kind of share in how the institution will be shared between the Hutu group and Tutsi groups.
Yeah, could I just say to you that for our listeners, it's very interesting. Not only does Burundi and Rwanda resemble each other so much demographically, but you also entered into the similar agreements because Rwanda had an Arusha agreement. I suppose we ought to make it Arusha Rwanda, Arusha Burundi, but they were rather comparable in the way they set out to solve the problems. My understanding is that in Burundi, you were successful in that the parties did say, okay, we're going to have elections and we're going to live with the results, and power will be shared according to the success or failure of political parties, resulting in the selection, legal, open selection of the present president of Burundi. Is that accurate?
Yes, we have succeeded. Burundi has succeeded on this because the Arusha agreement was really applied by the actual government. Literally, exactly what was written, that's what they did. 50% for both groups in the security forces. For the public service, 60% for the Hutu and 40% for the Tutsi group. And so there was a share in parliament, in public service, and this has been really respected by the actual government until today. Mm-hmm. And that's why we do not understand exactly why this crisis is coming around the Arusha agreement, why nothing has changed since the signature of this agreement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you have an agreement that's in place. And on this program, we have interviewed legal authorities who said, Arusha has already, the agreement has already been accomplished in Burundi in that they met all the criteria and then proceeded to elect the president. His name is Nkurunziza, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Nkurunziza was elected. From there on, it isn't really necessary even to discuss Arusha anymore because Burundi has already met all the standards. Parties are free to be in opposition, etc. But then you had a constitutional issue, which is to be decided by the Burundian people. That is, he was appointed the first time by the parliament. He ran for election once. Then he said, I want to run a second time. They said, oh, no, that would be two terms. But it wouldn't be two terms with the election, you know, with a popular election. So the Supreme Court of Burundi agreed with the position that, yes, he has a right to run for office twice to be selected by the people.
True, yes.
And when he attempted to carry out, following his constitution, by the way, the United States had a very similar one where Gore ran against Bush. Gore thought he had more votes. Bush said he didn't. The Supreme Court said Bush was right, and Mr. Gore went home. But in your country, something else happened. Mr. Nkurunziza was to go ahead with his business as the president. An election was scheduled, and yes. Instead of an election, you had a coup, an attempted
yes.
coup. Who
yes.
did that, and why?
according to the information that I have, what the official version, on May 13, 2015, yes, there was a coup attempt led by General Godefroid Niyombare, this is the name in Kurundi, with a former Minister of National Defense under President Pierre Buyoya. And this is very, very important to note. Niyombare was a coup, but with a former Minister of National Defense under Pierre Buyoya. And this is what we, members of the collective, this is the thing that we want to show to people, why this second person, not the first, the second, is an indication. This happened when the President of the Republic was participating in a summit of head of state at the top of the sub-region in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania.
Yes.
But there is something that we need to emphasize on. It is that the coup and the protest insurgency were somehow linked, and you could see it on the pictures that were shown from Bujumbura. You could see that there was really a kind of a common understanding between the people who did the coup and those who were protesting. And now we know that those who are protesting are youth from Tutsi neighborhood in Bujumbura, and it's only four neighborhood in Bujumbura, and we were happy with the push. So for we Burundians who have lived in Burundi, this is tells us way too much.
Mm-hmm. It's very much. One is that somebody from Buyoya's group was involved, because Mr. Buyoya was notorious illegally in power and also violently in power when before he was chased out of the country. So somebody from his group was involved in the coup. But, you know, you put your finger on a very important point, and I've noticed the commentary. We had Mr. Gerald O'Coleman on our program, and he talked about it, that the Western media has represented the demonstrations in Burundi as though it was a countrywide phenomena, but actually it apparently is a couple of neighborhoods in Bujumbura, not the country.
Yes. It is, again, a very important thing to pinpoint, because there has been mass manipulation of the public information on this. And being a Burundian and knowing what our country is, people need to know that first, Bujumbura has, if in terms of municipalities around, Burundi has about 129 municipalities, mm-hmm. and only four or five of the 129 municipalities have this kind of insurgency and a protest. And it is very important to clarify this for those who follow what is happening in Burundi.
Would it be correct to say that those are Buyoya neighborhoods?
Exactly. There is something specific to these four neighborhoods. In 1993, after the killing of the first Hutu president, democratically elected Melchior Ndadaye, these neighborhoods, they cleaned the neighborhood from any presence of Hutu and they killed them. This is the neighborhood where they were killing Hutu by burning tires and putting them on the neck. In French, the surprise du feu. And they remain the same until today. And that's why it is not a secret for a member of the collective to imagine that it had an ethnic side, even if they pretended not. It is.
Mm-hmm. There's additional matters to do with that, the coup. There were the West has said, the government, in response to the attempted coup, and by the way, this is a very serious coup when it's a general involved, and he's announcing that he's the government. Every government in the world that struggles against a coup shuts everything down, as we can see in Brussels today, where the great city of Brussels is shut down entirely because there's one guy that they're looking for. So in the case of Burundi, you had a military man who claimed he had taken power. So they, and along the way, there, a couple of radio stations broadcast that general's coup announcements and treated him like the government. And both of those, two of those that I know about, were foreign owned. Is that accurate?
Yes.
And they were, I think they call themselves NGOs.
Yes. We need to go back because the actual government has allowed radios and media really to, and is in any democracy to be, they had the freedom. Mm-hmm. Freedom from media, and this was the kind of progress in Burundi because before media were not allowed, private media were not allowed, but the actual government has allowed media to be implemented in Burundi. And now, now what we do know is some media were funded by some NGO, mm-hmm. and here I will mention one of them, the name is RPA. This one was a radio, and I heard from Canada. I heard many Tutsi here in Canada really praising RPA, and I didn't know because I was too far to understand. But now with the crisis, I know why Tutsis here in Canada were praising this RPA as a great radio and so on. Mm-hmm. And this specific radio was funded by, I think, an ambassador of President Obama. Her name is Samantha Power. I think she's the ambassador at the UN for USA. And she's one of those who funded this RPA. And now we can understand that she does have interest in Burundi. And we do understand why there is why this specific person, Samantha Power, now.
And they broadcast the general's announcement that he had taken power.
Yeah.
Maybe he meant Samantha Power. I don't know.
Yeah.
And by the way, the famous French right-wing philosopher who loves to invade countries in the name of humanitarian interventionism, Mr. Lévy, I think, I forget how his initials. He's only known by his initials in France. He was one of those who sponsored the attack on Libya and celebrated it. He also had a radio station in Bujumbura, and he also, his station, supported the coup makers by broadcasting their claim that they had seized power.
For us, it is a pattern. We can now really say that the people are well supported by foreign countries such as USA through Samantha Power, and by Belgium and by France and by Rwanda, mm-hmm. and it is not a mystery for us to know that if it was not this kind of support, maybe we would not be in this actual crisis. Mm-hmm. And it is very clear for us, members of the collective, that there is an intention to stop elections in Burundi. It is not about the eligibility of the president. It is, yes, about this kind, they call it the CNDD-FDD government. But for us, what we read is they do not want any Hutu running Burundi, or they do not want the majority running Burundi, and they can deduct that if democracy is maintained in the Burundi and president come from election by the citizen, then they think that the Hutu had the chance to have a president. And this is what was great with democracy elsewhere, and we are hoping that this can be protected in Burundi also for us as victims of what happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly it's a... In my opinion, it's been a lack of what they call light on the subject. Instead, the media here has simply gone along with what Samantha Powers and the French NGOs would like us to think, rather than to look at the realities, as you've been, for example, laying out for us here. Is it true that those who attempted the violent overthrow and failed of a few months back, that many of them or all of them have gone to Rwanda?
The answer is yes. And it is strange, too. According to the crisis that went through in Burundi before this one, it was it is unusual to see people from Burundi really fleeing, most of them fleeing to Rwanda. Normally they would flee to Tanzania or to Congo, some to Rwanda, but at this time there is a pattern that especially those who did the coup, they all fled in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And now we do know that they are not refugees there. They are really well treated. They seem they have been welcomed by Rwanda. And they are even allowed to continue to work on their plot from Rwanda. And
yes.
That's how...
And to arm and train people to commit crimes and to invade the sovereign state of Burundi. Is that right?
Yes, and it did occur. I do not remember the date, but I believe three times after the coup, Burundi... One before the coup, there was an invasion of Burundi from Rwanda. Mm-hmm. The two second occurred after the coup d'etat, and they really, yes, came from Rwanda, because for those who know the map of Burundi, when you attack from the north, that's the border between Burundi and Rwanda. If you hear any invasion from the north of Burundi, it is evidence that those people are coming from Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not, it is true and believed and confirmed that there were attacks conducted directly from Rwanda on the Burundi soil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, this is Fred Ziamana, and I thank you, by the way, for giving us so much time today. But and you, he is the coordinator of the survivors and victims of the 1972 genocide in Burundi. And there's a very important name. And for people who, I hope our listeners who particularly focus on Africa, this is really appreciate the information we're able to provide today, because if you actually care about these matters, you have to be precise of who you're talking about. When in the lead up to the coup, the attempted coup, they formed a united front of opponents of the President Nkurunziza. And they said the leader of the movement was Agathon Rwasa. And they made a great deal over this because Mr. Rwasa, I understand, is Hutu. So they said he is the leader and he says that Mr. Nkurunziza has to go. But when they attempted the coup and the election went forward, Mr. Rwasa said he wasn't going to have anything to do with the coup. And he said that he believed his duty was to serve in the new parliament. And I notice they're not very happy with that. Can you talk about what happened there and your opinion about why Mr. Rwasa made the decision he made?
Because it is true that now Agathon Rwasa is the chair of the opposition at the parliament, and we're happy with that. And it is true also that he was parliament before. And so ENC has decided now to join the actual government, and we can really say thank you to him, because this it helps to peace, and this would be his contribution. My opinion is that we learn from our mistakes. So
let's hope so.
Again, from in my view, because the way I read is, as a member of the collective, I could tell you that Agathon Rwasa before was manipulated by those to see him, because that's how they do it. They always need a Hutu face to show and to hide their ethnic face or intention. And some Hutu do believe in it and sometimes work with them until they realize that they have been manipulated, and they might be used like in this situation, like to block a country or to destroy your own country. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that Agathon Rwasa.
Well, it's a very important point. I mean, he remains an opponent in the sense that he's a political opponent, but he's obeying the laws and constitution of his country. The others decided to use the situation to try to violently change the former government and the leadership. Another question I want to make sure I ask you. There is a report, and I think it's established, but I want whether you can confirm it, that the leaders of the coup who fled the country and were enabled to escape by neighboring states, but particularly Rwanda apparently, held a meeting perhaps 1 month or so after in Addis Ababa, 50 of them who were part of that. Is that true?
It might be true. I don't have any information on that. But again, from my own experience, anything that is said regarding what is happening in Rwanda, including the Al-Shabaab, we know that Burundi is fighting, is helping to stop the fighting in Somalia, and there was a threat that Al-Shabaab may attack Burundi just to punish him for its involvement in the UN effort to stop fighting in Somalia. Now, I would not be surprised to learn that these people may be helped by Rwanda and those who conducted the putsch.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have, one of the reasons I raised that was that sometimes it's lost track of that Addis Ababa was a close ally of Paul Kagame when he seized power in Rwanda. He was intimate with the Ethiopian government, let's put it that way.
Yes. Again, as a member of the collective, we don't believe that those things are true, because for me, the Hima Empire is a reality for me. I don't believe that it must be true, because I can see, I would not be able to tell you why Kagame would want to attack Burundi and so on if it was not with Hima Empire. Mm-hmm. Because there is no conflict between territory conflict or whatever between Rwanda and Burundi. What would be the other reason except that Rwanda has some intention regarding the Hima Empire, and it goes through from Rwanda to Uganda and all the way to Ethiopia. And,
Well, there's of course
we have to
There's a rather famous empire, the American, the French, and the Belgian, etc., who seem to have a habit of finding people to cause problems in order to reassert themselves in the region.
I have another point to make on this. Yeah. In this actual crisis, like a week ago or 2 weeks ago, there was a YouTube of one Burundian, two three Burundians named Jar. Now his name is Yohanan. He was saying on a Rwanda radio, showing how the Tutsi in Burundi, the Tutsi in Rwanda are all Jewish.
Oh, yes.
And that's this fight in Burundi is a fight against, is a fight of Hutu against the Tutsi Jewish in Burundi.
There are several theories that seem to get loose like a virus in that region. Unfortunately, some of the broadcasters there seem to let it go. One of the things I notice about Rwanda is that there's a lot of programs based on religion. They do a lot of Pentecostal broadcasting and that sort of thing, which is certainly causes bad blood within the community. Let me just ask you last thing. We have a crisis in the sense that the Western, certainly British, the French, and U.S. have agreed to basically put a kind of, embargo on the leadership of Burundi. But I don't see Tanzania and other powers in the region, pardon me, going in on that. How concerned are you about that kind of economic threat to Burundi?
Too bad. Too bad for Burundi, because first, Burundi is a poor country, and when you impose this kind of threat on a poor country, this is the other way to kill the population of Burundi. Okay. Yes, we do believe that now there is some countries like such as Belgium and France and in the USA and the United Kingdom trying to come to and to push the UN to accept to put an embargo on Burundi, and we were very happy to know that at the UN this request was not accepted by other members. And we were happy to know that what happened in the United Nations, that the Security Council recognized the sovereignty of Burundi as a country, mm-hmm. and the sovereignty of the government to protect its population and to undertake whatever the government of Burundi believes to be the best way to conduct whatever is dialogue and the way they want to do it and the people that we want to involve in this dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it was very good to hear that the Security Council so mm-hmm. was understanding and didn't take literally what these countries were trying to do on Burundi, and we have here to be very thankful for the government of Russia mm-hmm. and the government of China, and yes. we need to be thankful too in Africa for the government of Tanzania, especially the government of Angola, and of course, the government of South Africa, who are now really trying to help Burundi to get to overcome this this kind of diplomatic mm-hmm. Other problems, because there is a fight in Burundi and there is this kind of mm-hmm. political problem outside of Burundi. Sometimes it can become very tough for a country, a small country like Burundi, or the actual government, to be able to mm-hmm. To justify that it has the right to its sovereignty, or the right to protect its own populations exactly the way they want to do it, like any and a panda on the government elsewhere.
Ah. Well, Frederick, I think we managed to find a positive note to end on. That is encouraging. I was rather losing hope, but I think you've made a picture which is rather encouraging. And I thank you very much. Fred Ziamana, who is the coordinator of the survivors and victims of 1972 Hutu genocide in Burundi. Again, thank you, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
You're welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Bye-bye.